Open your text, if you would, to Luke, the 17th chapter. We're going to begin this evening by reading some verses from this text. It will be our primary text for the evening in Luke 17, and we'll start in verse 11, going down through verse 19. It's not a real famous story as far as the details are concerned, but the basics of it we all seem to know and remember. But I want to start by talking about Gulliver's Travels for just a moment. In that book, the big book, I read the short version, the kid version. Jonathan Swift, through his writing of that particular book about the Lilliputians, had a lot to say about morality. And in that book, based on Lilliputian law, ingratitude was considered a capital offense. Failing to show gratitude to someone who had done something for you was punishable by death, is what that means. Ingratitude is reckoned among them a capital crime, for they reason thus, that whoever makes ill return to his benefactors must needs be a common enemy to the rest of mankind, from whom he hath received no obligation. And therefore such a man is not fit to live. Though it sounds severe, the reasoning and the logic is sound. If a man does the disfavor and the rude reaction to a benevolent deed toward him, if he treats or renders to that ingratitude, what is going to be his reaction to those who don't do him good? And so through Mr. Swift's writing about the Lilliputian law, we come to understand the importance of gratitude in ways that perhaps we had not previously thought about it. Now, we're not going to be talking about Gulliver's Travels all the way through this. You know that basic story. But I know of no story, no account. Gulliver's Travels was a fictional story. We're going to read a true story or a true account tonight. And I know of no place in the Bible that highlights the need for gratitude and shows the insensitivity of ingratitude more than what we're going to read. I thought also about Joseph and the butler and the baker. That one relates to ingratitude very much also, but I don't think in the same ways as this one does. So read with me from Luke 17, and we're going to read through this once, and then I'll go back and make some comments, and then we'll make some applications toward the end. Luke 17, beginning in verse 11, and it came about that while he was on the way to Jerusalem, that he was passing between Samaria and Galilee. And as he entered a certain village, there met him 10 leprous men who stood at a distance. And they raised their voices saying, "Jesus, Master, have mercy on us." And when he saw them, he said to them, "Go and show yourselves to the priest." And it came about that as they were going, they were cleansed. Now one of them, when he saw that he had been healed, turned back, glorifying God with a loud voice. And he fell on his face at his, that is Jesus' feet, giving thanks to him. And he was a Samaritan. And Jesus answered and said, "Were there not 10 cleansed? But the 9, where are they? Were none found who turned back to give glory to God except this foreigner?" And he said to him, "Rise and go your way. Your faith has made you well." There's a couple of points of emphasis that may highlight some of the details of this story and make them a little more vivid for you. from verse 11, for instance, realize that one of these men, and we saw it also in verse 16 and in verse 18, that at least one of these men was a Samaritan. Jesus was traveling between Galilee, which is north and west of the Sea of Galilee, through Samaria, headed to Jerusalem. It's interesting that Luke tries to put things in chronological order. He doesn't cover everything sequentially. In other words, he omits some events. But the ones that are covered by Luke are pretty much in chronological order. That was his intent if you read the first four verses of Luke chapter 1. Now, in the listing of Jesus' miracles, there are about 40 of them, depending on how you want to count and look at things and whether this was the same account in one gospel or is it a different account of a different miracle, much like the other one. So somewhere around 40 miracles. This would be the 32nd of Jesus' miracles. He's heading to Jerusalem for the last time. So this is toward the end of his ministry. Perhaps very near to the end of his ministry. He's going between Galilee and Samaria. Samaria was a region, but it had was the capital city for the northern 10 tribes as long as they existed. Remember when the kingdom split between north and south? Judah was the capital in the southern 2 tribes. Samaria was the capital of the northern 10 tribes. Then Samaria ultimately fell along with those northern 10 tribes. Shalmaneser V of Assyria finally had enough of Israel. The Israel tried to revolt and stop paying taxes to them and didn't go well. Hoshea was the king at the time. Shalmaneser comes in there and just destroys them. He leaves only the poorest of the poor behind, pretty much takes everybody else or kills everybody else, and the northern 10 tribes basically ceases to exist as such. Now, when the Assyrians conquered a territory, they didn't leave it vacant because then somebody else would move in and settle their territory. So they imported probably other captives from other areas, but they would settle them in the land that they've conquered. They did that in Samaria. The people that they brought in, probably captives perhaps even from Babylon or other people with, more likely Egyptians, but whatever, bring them into Samaria and they intermarry and intermixed with those poorest of the poor of the Jews who were left behind, making a mixed breed of people called Samaritans. Now that may help to explain to you in John 4 and verse 9 why the Samaritan woman was so surprised that Jesus would talk to her, because John adds the further comment that the Samaritans had nothing to do with the Jews and basically the Jews had nothing to do with the Samaritans. It was reciprocal in that regard. They didn't like each other. The Jews viewed them as half-breeds at best and interlopers settling Jewish lands. The Samaritans, because of that hatred, didn't think very highly of the Jews either. But here is a group, at least one of whom is a Samaritan. I'm assuming, and it is an assumption, that perhaps all 10 of these are Samaritans. Maybe not. We know one of them was. But that highlights what Jesus says in verse 19 of our text. The only one who was appreciative and returned and gave thanks and praise and glory to God was the foreigner. The word faith appears more than 225 times in the New Testament. More than that. Jesus used the term great faith twice. In both times it was directed toward a Gentile. So when he sees that this Samaritan is the one who comes back, we'll talk about that in a second, comes back and gives thanks, it further highlights to him the depravity of his own nation. He's used great faith only twice in his public ministry, and in both times it was toward Gentiles, Canaanites. That had to hurt. So, in verse 11 of our text there, Jesus is coming back toward Jerusalem. He's between Galilee and Samaria. He encounters at a certain village these 10 men who are leprous men. They did exactly what the law in Leviticus 13 prescribed them to do. They may have been Samaritans, but in this case, they're at least following the law of Leviticus 13. I think it's verses, I wrote it down somewhere, 45 and 46, which required them to stay at a distance and to shout unclean toward anyone who would approach them. Those verses also indicate that leprous people were to live apart, isolated from everyone else, to live alone, at least alone from other clean people. They had to stay to themselves in colonies or in groups that included other leprous people. Understand a little bit about leprosy. I don't want to go into a lot of detail. It is a degenerative skin disease that attacks the cartilage, or specifically the amino acids and such that holds the cartilages together in your body. And as it progresses, the skin begins to turn red and then white. And as it progresses further, it begins attacking those cartilages and destroying them, literally eating them away. It takes away basically the glue that holds those cartilaginous cells together. So they just dissolve. Now think about what your body would be without cartilage. Your ears would disappear, and they did. Your joints would have no protection to keep them from being bone on bone, and they were. Your nose would eventually no longer be there. Most people with leprosy die of infection if it is uncorrected or does not reverse itself. There was no cure for leprosy at that time, although it sometimes would go into remission, as a lot of diseases do. That's why Leviticus 14 talks about if you're cleansed, you go show yourself to the priest, and there's an elaborate ceremony and everything that has to be gone through to pronounce you cleansed so that you could go back into society from which you've been isolated the entire time that your leprosy is manifested. So this was an isolated, lonely, painful, slow death disease. Brother Mike, help me get this right. They were helpless, hopeless, and hapless. I didn't get those in the right order. Helpless, hapless, and hopeless. I think that's it. He told me that. I like that. Those three go together. That's a good description of the life of a leper, without hope because there was no cure. Hapless because what do you do? And helpless. There's no one that can change this except for this man that these men hear about. How they knew about Jesus, we don't know. He's already cleansed one leper. Matthew 8 records that. And when John the Baptist sent a message to him asking if he was the Christ, because John has been stuck in prison since the time that Jesus was baptized almost, Jesus says the blind are made to see, the lame walk, the dead are raised, and the lepers are cleansed. So as you look at the miracles that Jesus did, cleansing of lepers was among them. And these men no doubt heard about that. If they didn't know anything about Jesus before, that would certainly pique their interest because that's their dilemma. If you've got that kind of deadly disease and there's no hope, and you hear that somebody can cleanse it, you have now hope. And so when this multitude that's following Jesus comes near to where they are, they go out looking. And they address him, notice from the text. They stood at a distance, which the law required of them, and they raised their voices saying, Jesus, Master, have mercy on me. Think about three things. They recognized Jesus. They knew or had heard what he was capable of doing. They recognized his power and authority over their particular malady, and their plea was based on mercy. Not worthiness. They didn't come to him saying, we're brethren of yours, we're Samaritans. They said, have mercy on us. They didn't claim worthiness. They pled for mercy. So they recognized Jesus. They knew who he was. They acknowledged his power and authority by calling and referring to him as Master. And they pled for mercy rather than their worthiness. Look in the first part of verse 14 of our text. And when he saw this, he said to them, "Go show yourselves to the priest." Now, the thing you need to understand about that, and perhaps you already do, maybe you don't, that was to be done after the leprosy had disappeared. They weren't told to go to the priest for treatment. They were told to go to the priest for certification that they were healed, that the leprosy was gone. And the priest, by making sacrifices for them and going through this, read Leviticus 14, it's all there. Going through this elaborate ceremony could then, over time, pronounce them as clean, in effect certifying them as fit and able to return to society, return to their families, and return to fellowship, because they could then return to worship in the synagogue as well. All of which they had been prohibited throughout the time of their disease. So they were isolated from family, they were separated from society, and they couldn't even worship. Removed from fellowship as well because of this disease. So Jesus tells them, "You go show yourselves to the priest." That was to be done when the leprosy was gone. When Jesus said it, it wasn't gone. Now, notice the text carefully in the latter part of verse 14. And it came about that as they were going, let me ask you a question. If they hadn't started toward the priest, would the leprosy have gone? You say, "Well, I don't know." I do. Look down in the text. Verse 19. "Your faith has made you well." If they didn't have the faith, if they didn't have the courage to act upon that faith and to start toward the priest, even though they were still leprous, it wouldn't have been cleansed. But because they had the faith to do what Jesus told them to do, trusting that they would be cleansed. Does that start to sound like baptism a little bit to you? Well, there's nothing in the water. Yes, there is. There's the saving blood of Jesus. Because he says, if you do this, you will be clean. So he says to them, you go to the priest, which is the activity that is required of someone who is cleansed. Meaning they had to go in faith, believing that it was the right thing to do. Trusting that Jesus is going to make this right. That whatever, however they may understand it or not understand it, they're to go to the priest and they know what for. To be certified as clean. So they start on that journey, and as they go, they were cleansed. Now I want you to think about that for just a moment. The text does not tell us how long they had been in this condition. But however long it had been, they had been isolated, separated from their family completely. They had been separated from any social or other human contact. And they had also been prevented from fellowship, worship, encouragement, any of those things that you want to talk about that come with assembling with others for the purpose of worshiping God. However long they had been leprous, they had been separated from all of those things. And as they're going, I can't imagine how this worked, but they noticed. They noticed they were cleansed. Now put yourself in their sandals for a moment. Put yourselves in their skin for a moment. At whatever degree of the leprosy they had, however far it had progressed, however long they've had it, they've suffered, and now as they're going to the priest, they notice it's gone. I don't know whether that was just gradual or whether it was all, I don't know. But I can imagine how they felt at that moment.
gone.
This death sentence of suffering has been removed. All of the pain that is associated with my disease, my condition, is gone. My knees work right. Maybe my nose starts to grow back and my ears are formed. I don't know. But it's gone. They're whole again. And they know they're going to be able to see their families. They know they're going to go to the store. To meet at the city square with the other men of town and just talk about, you know, spit and whittle kind of thing, okay? To go back to their synagogue. All of that is now going to be able to take place. His requirement was exactly what the law said they were supposed to do when they were cleansed. But they were told to go do it before they were cleansed. That helps to explain the latter part of verse 14 and verse 19 when he says, "Your faith has made you well." From this story then, gratitude. And I hope by going into the details, our understanding and appreciation of gratitude is now heightened. We see the gratitude of the one. And we see also the glaring omission in the nine. Why didn't they go back and give praise to God and thank Jesus that their lives had been spared, that everything that they had lost because of this disease had been returned to them in an instant, in that moment? Their lives were back. Their families were back. Their church's synagogue was back. Everything that they had lost, they had regained. Of this man. How could you not be grateful for that? Well, think about it for a moment. Perhaps they were so excited and relieved, they just got overcome with joy. And I don't know if they went to the priest or not. They were headed that way, but once they were cleansed, I don't know whether they even remembered to go to the priest or not. Probably so, to get the certification, because then they had to rush home and see those family members that they hadn't been able to hug or touch. Perhaps their own child that they had never gotten to hold. Maybe they just forgot in the excitement and the relief of simply having their lives given back to them. Perhaps they couldn't wait to get to the priest to get that certification that would allow them to do that. Maybe they were still going to do what Jesus had told them to do, which was to go to the priest. The Bible doesn't say. And so all of this is just conjecture. Perhaps any of these things could be true. Perhaps none of them are true. We don't know why they didn't. We know they didn't. Although we recognize ingratitude and understand something of the additional problems that it can spawn, here's my question for you. Do we really stop to think what produces or causes ingratitude in ourselves or in our children? Hopefully we understand the importance of gratitude. But if it's not present in me or in my children, you and your children, how do we correct that? I'm a big believer in you can't really prescribe a solution until you know exactly what the problem is. The cause. What's caused this? Here's the disease, ingratitude. Now, what has caused that particular ingratitude? Until we understand the exact cause of that ingratitude, we don't know exactly how to treat it, how to correct it. So for just a moment, I want you to think about potential causes of ingratitude. I did some limited crowdsourcing on this. That's a new term. Do I sound hip? My crowdsourcing was kind of limited. It was Donna, James, and Brenda because they were the ones at the house this afternoon. But we put our heads together on this. I already had some ideas and knew kind of where I wanted to go, but I got some good input from them as well. And I want you to think with me for just a moment or two more about some potential causes of gratitude. The first thing that came to my mind, and they had various expressions that all kind of melded into this one point, a simple cause of ingratitude is selfishness. That sounds axiomatic, but I don't mean it to be. Selfishness, as I'm talking about it, is an overemphasis of or a preoccupation with me that is usually combined with a myopic view of everyone else. I only see me. And therefore, I'm only concerned about me. And because of that, I'm not really concerned about others. And if it's all about me all the time, then I deserve everything I get. And I'm not really worried about how it affects somebody else. So I think one of the root causes, and you can disagree with these if you want, they're obviously subjective, but I think at least one of the root causes of ingratitude is an overemphasis or a preoccupation with me. Selfishness. In Philippians 2 and in verse 3, Paul writes to the Philippians and says exactly the opposite of these things. He says, do nothing, Philippians 2 verse 3, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, let each of you regard one another as more important than self. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to go out on a limb. An ungrateful person never does that. So there is a link, and maybe I haven't correctly identified it in very specific terms, but I believe there's an absolute link between selfishness and ingratitude. We've got the wrong perception of our own importance compared to everyone else's, and that renders us incapable of being grateful for anything that anyone else does for us. Because it's all about me, and well, that's what you should have done for me, after all. So, number one, selfishness. Number two, and this obviously dovetails or comes from, however you want to describe these, this is connected to the selfishness, is a sense of entitlement. A sense of entitlement can result when we think we deserve everything that we have or everything that we receive, everything that someone else does for us, and therefore we are ungrateful for any of it. Because, well, I deserve the very best. I'm entitled to the very best. Part of what's wrong with our country, my view, is this sense of entitlement that people have. That they think they are entitled to the best of everything. Regardless, and it's completely separate from any responsibility that is theirs in the first place for not having those things. So if I don't have it and you do, you have to give it to me. That kind of entitlement is very much linked to an improper view of self in the first place. That's where it comes from. But it renders us, again, incapable of gratitude. In Romans, the third chapter, Romans chapter 3 on this point, in Romans chapter 3, Paul begins in verse 9 by saying, what then, are we better than they? Not at all. For we have already charged that both Jews and Greeks are all under sin. And then he quotes from Psalm 14 and Psalm 5 and Psalm 140 and says, there is none righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands. There is no one who seeks God. And I think the psalmist and even Paul in quoting this is hyperbolizing to some degree. But we are these people. Because in verse 23 he says, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. While we may not fit all of the things listed there in verse 10 through verse 18, we're for sure going to fit one of them. which brings us under condemnation before God, and therefore, verse 23, guilty of sin, and from Romans chapter 6 and verse 23, deserving of death. Now, how does that make you feel? Deserving of death for your sin. Think about these people that were lepers. They had a death sentence because of that disease. They didn't deserve to live any more than anybody else. They didn't deserve to die more than anybody else. They were all guilty of sin, and yet they were spared and given life. So when we have a sense of entitlement, I think it renders us as incapable of gratitude. And what we do when we have that sense of entitlement is that we forget some things. In Acts the 14th chapter and in verse 16 and 17, Paul says, "And in the generations gone by, he permitted all the nations to go their own ways, and yet he did not leave himself without witness, and that he did good and gave you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness." He says that's a witness of God's goodness and God's provision to you. When we forget about what God has done for us in the past, we start to think we're entitled in the present. In James 1 and verse 17, it says that every good and perfect gift comes from God. Now, as much as that emphasizes that it comes from God, think about the word gift for a moment. Is a gift something that is deserved or to which we are entitled? Our oldest son, when he was little, when it came around his birthday, he told everybody it was his birthday. And it being his birthday entitled him to anything that he wanted to eat and as much of it as he wanted. One year he wanted bacon. When we had bacon, he only got a couple of pieces. Had to share with his mom and dad and his brother. But when it was his birthday, he wanted bacon. And Don said, "What am I going to do?" I said, "You cook him as much bacon as he can hold." He thought he was entitled. Think about that for just a moment. What is it that we do to deserve a birthday gift? We were born. We had absolutely nothing to do with that. There is no entitlement to that. When we are born again, it's an operation of God. Yes, we're involved. We submit to His will, but He provides the cleansing. He provided the seed. He provides the gestation. He provides the growth of the plant. That doesn't make us entitled. Third thing I want you to think about as a cause for ingratitude, and this is something that was important to me, at least for my understanding of this, affluence. People who have never had to make do with little or next to nothing are people who have never had to go without tend to have more difficulty with gratitude. Think about it. Who appreciates the next meal more? A man who's never missed a meal or a man who's missed every meal for the last week? Which one of those two is going to be grateful for what he has when he sits down and eats a meal? So by abundance, we can become ungrateful. Think of all the things these lepers had gone without. Simple health, contact with families, societal interaction, spiritual fellowship and encouragement. All of these deprivations should have made all of them extremely grateful for Jesus' provision. Or restoration of them. And it did so for one of them. But it didn't for all of them. Read with me from Philippians, the fourth chapter, for just a moment. In Philippians 4, There's a verse that I almost cringe when I hear people read or quote it because it's almost always misapplied. I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. He's not talking about winning a ball game or hitting a home run. Okay. Back up to verse 10. Paul says, "But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly." Why, Paul? Why are you rejoicing in the Lord? "That now at last you revived your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned before, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am in." What circumstances, Paul? Keep reading. "I know how to get along with humble means." That means doing without. "And I know also how to live in prosperity." That means having an abundance. How did he know how to live in abundance and still be grateful and rejoicing? He had been without. I'm not making excuses for people, but I think I understand hoarders in this way. People that lived through the Great Depression and had that lack, that constant lack of everything implanted and embedded in their minds, now that they have something, they don't want to let go of anything. I'm not talking about hoarding tonight, but I am trying to impress upon us that when we have had to do without, we appreciate more when we have. Think about how that relates to your children. When we give them everything they ever wanted, we're encouraging a lack of gratitude. They need to learn that they can get by without some things. They don't have to have everything their heart desires. Affluence, I believe, can be a cause of ingratitude, an overabundance of things. Fourthly, an overemphasis of the present. It's also known as impatience. You remember when the children of Israel were wandering in the wilderness and they got fed up with bread and water? "We loathe this miserable food." What did they forget? I suggest to you they forgot two things. They forgot the deliverance from slavery that God had just given them. And they had forgot the provision that He had made for them in Canaan. Why? Because all they could think about was the now. "I don't like the now. So I forgot about all the wonderful things you did for me in the past. And I'm not even really concerned about all the things you've promised for me in the future because I'm not happy with now." Sound immature?
Yeah.
But that's a contributing factor to ingratitude. Look in 2 Peter 1 for just a second. 2 Peter, the first chapter. I'm not going to read all of this, but I want to point out a couple things to you. 2 Peter 1. He says in verse 2, "Grace and peace be multiplied to you in the knowledge of God and of our Lord Jesus Christ. Seeing that His divine power has granted to you," notice that's past tense, "He's granted to you everything pertaining to life and godliness through the true knowledge of Him who has called us by His own glory and excellence. For by these He has granted to us His precious and magnificent promises." Do you see how He's talked about the past and He's talked about the future? And now what does He say you need to do in the present? That's verses 5 through 7. Adding all those things to your faith. Now notice what He says in verse 8. "For if these qualities are yours and are increasing," those Christian graces, "they render you neither useless nor unfruitful in the true knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. For he who lacks these qualities is blind and short-sighted, having forgotten his purification from his former sins." That's exactly what happened to Israel. They forgot that God had already brought them out of slavery to a disease, to the Egyptians, to sin. Do you see how all those things are working together? They had forgotten about God's deliverance and they had forgotten about God's promise, what was ahead. All they could think about now was the present and how unsatisfied and unhappy they were with the present. In 2 Corinthians, the 4th chapter, notice what Paul tells us, the Corinthians and us, all Christians. Notice what he says. Think of it in these terms as we've been discussing now. And look at verse 16. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 16. Therefore we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, we're worried about the here and now. We're impatient with the here and now. We're ungrateful for what we have because it's not what we want. This doesn't work right. That doesn't work. The outer man is decaying. Yeah, God knows that. God knows that. But where were you? Lost in sin. Where are you now? Saved in Christ. Where are you going? Keep reading. Therefore we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction, that's the here and now, is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. That's the hereafter. Verse 18, while we look not at the things which are seen, that's the here and now, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. We can overemphasize the present and lead ourselves right out of gratefulness, gratitude for what God has done for us and the provisions He has made for us in the future. Fifthly and finally, a mistaken sense of self-reliance or self-assertiveness. I guess you could call it excessive pride. Is a pretty sure way to wind up being ungrateful. If we believe we don't need others, if we believe specifically we don't need God, I can do it all by myself with every situation, every circumstance, and furthermore, I have always done it all by myself, we are never going to be grateful to anyone for anything. Because we've deceived ourselves. None of us does it that way. None of us came into life here without the help of others. There was a mother and a father or somebody that cared for you. That raised you. You didn't provide for yourself for those first few hours, for those first few weeks, for those first few months, years, decades for some of you. None of us is completely self-reliant. And none of us is completely self-assertive so that we don't need anything from anybody. Nobody has ever been like that. Read with me from Romans 1 and we'll wrap this up. In Romans, the first chapter, notice the language that is employed here. He says in Romans chapter 1, I want to start in verse 21. For even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks. That's gratefulness. But they became futile in their speculation and their foolish heart was darkened. What did they do, Paul? Professing to be wise, they became fools. How did that manifest itself, Paul? Look in verse 23. They exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man. They worshiped the creature rather than the Creator. You didn't create yourself. No one is self-made. And in spiritual terms, how much more is that true? Someone taught us. Someone led us. And even if they didn't, even if we found a Bible and studied it and read it and did exactly what God said, He still saved us, not on the basis of deeds which we have done, by His grace and His mercy. If we follow Christ's example, we will be kind even to the ungrateful. I want to go back to Luke and just read one verse for you here. And Luke 6 and in verse 35, Jesus says, love your enemies, do good and lend, expecting nothing in return. Your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for He Himself is kind to ungrateful. Kind to ungrateful and evil men. If we follow Christ's example, we will be kind even to the ungrateful, but we will never become one of them ourselves. You can't follow Christ and be ungrateful. Don't be selfish. You're not entitled to anything. Doing or being without is good for us and for our children from time to time at least. Never allow right now to overshadow what God has done for you in the past and what He promises to do for you in the future. And never assume that you can do it on your own. I see signs all over. It says, just be kind. And I like that. I think that's true. But do we understand that kindness usually stems from gratefulness? We are kind to others because we understand what God has done for us. I hope this helps. I hope it helps me to be more grateful. I hope it helps you. I hope it helps us to help our children be the kind of grateful people that we ought to be, rather than like these nine who were obviously not as grateful as they should have been. You've been patient. You've been kind. I've talked longer than I should have, which is probably nothing new, but I appreciate that in you and for it. Love you for it. If we can help you tonight to be right with God, you come while we stand and while we stand.